Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Consider yourself just another African mammal, my friend, the descendant of primates, the slow byproduct of eons of evolution from ground ape to upright walking human. It is this humbling proposition that our guest tonight, zoologist, wildlife artist, and evolutionary biologist Jonathan Kingdon, calls our greatest legacy and the guiding path for a successful human future. Tonight on Point, Jonathan Kingdon and the lowly origin of 6 billion modern humans. We begin with a nature in a swirl today with Hurricane Isabel buffeting much of the central Atlantic coast. Joining me from Newport News, Virginia, is Lynn Burke, a reporter with the Daily Press in Newport News. Lynn Burke, how's it going down there? What's the weather?
The weather is not clearing up, but the worst is past us, thank God.
What have you seen today in Newport News? You're right there in the middle of the central Atlantic where this thing was really coming ashore.
We have seen wind. We have seen rain. I'm 55 years old. I've never seen a day like this in my life, and I never want to see another one like this again.
Just in the intensity of wind and rain, describe
yes.
What you've witnessed.
We've witnessed outside our building here at the newspaper, just the trees bent almost double. The wind just pouring down. We have a weather station here at the newspaper, and last time I looked, we were over 14 inches of rain at our building.
14 inches.
14 inches, yes.
And Hurricane Isabel actually came ashore at somewhat less strength than was originally predicted.
We have been talking about this, yes. It was early in the week, I believe, 160-mile-an-hour winds. I think it was somewhere around 105, 110 when it finally came ashore. It was as bad as I've ever seen anything around here.
We read that 2,000 flights out of 19 airports were canceled today. Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
essentially shut down. Many states declared states of emergency. Kids
yeah.
in Virginia sent home from school. What happened with public life in Newport News today?
It pretty much ground to a halt. We had lots of advance warning. The amazing thing is we have one of the television stations in our area broadcasting out of our facilities here today, and I just was talking to some of their folks because they've been keeping a watch on the much broader picture, and they only know of one fatality in Virginia, nothing in this area of about 1 million people down here. There was so much advance warning. Everybody hunkered down, stayed home, went to shelters, just basically did nothing. I came in about 7 o'clock this morning down to the office. It's about a 15-minute drive, and hardly any cars on the road. Usually it would be busy, people going to work. Everything was shut down.
So what time did the full force of this storm hit you there?
It was starting to rain when I came in again around 7. The wind started to pick up maybe an hour later, probably from 10 o'clock until, say, 2 or 3 o'clock. It was pretty bad. 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock was the brunt of it. Then it started to kick back just a little bit.
We read that 250,000 people were told to evacuate low-lying areas of North Carolina and Virginia. Did people actually do that as this storm's intensity was marked down a bit?
I think a lot of people did because we're used to having hurricanes come up the coast, hit off the Outer Banks of North Carolina, and go out to sea. People, some hard heads tend to stay at home. I think a lot of people took the advice today for this week and just basically got out of Dodge.
You said, of course, that you've seen hurricanes come up the coast almost every season. You get touched in one way or another, but that you've never seen anything quite like this one.
Not like this one.
And what do you mean by that?
Just the intensity. Like I say, usually they will come up the coast. They won't. If they come inland, it'll be farther down in North Carolina. It'll go farther inland. We'll get some rain and some wind, but nothing that's come this close to us. We were on kind of the backside of it, so we were where the heaviest wind and rain, where we just really got nailed around here.
Lynn Burke, are you going to be driving home tonight or hunkering down at the newspaper there?
I, at some point, need to go see if I still have a house left. I've got 3 days worth of clothes here. The thing is, in this part of the U.S., the dominant power company is Virginia Power, Dominion Virginia Power.
Mm-hmm.
They have 2.2 million customers, 1.1 million, half of them, are out of, don't have power right now. In the area down here called Hampton Roads, they have like 560,000 customers. Probably 90 to 95% don't have power.
These are big numbers and presumably a lot of wires to be repaired.
A lot of wires. They had some crews out this morning until the winds got so bad that once they got up to 40 or 50 miles an hour, they pulled their crews off for the crew's safety. I'm sure once everything dies down, they'll be back out again. But chances are, you know, some folks probably won't see power for a week and a half.
Lynn, thanks for joining us, and be safe there.
Thank you very much.
Lynn Burke is a local reporter at the Daily Press. He spoke with me from Newport News, Virginia. Imagine growing up in Africa, in the wild heart of what is now Tanzania. Your mother, the artist, spurs your career as an Audubon-worthy portraitist of the continent's most exotic mammals. An intimate knowledge and love of natural history prompts a lifelong pursuit of some of science's most elusive insights into early man, how, when, and why our evolutionary ancestors first stood up. Our guest tonight, zoologist, artist, and celebrated British evolutionary biologist Jonathan Kingdon takes on exactly those questions in his new book, Lowly Origin. Americans may still be swinging somewhere between evolution and creationism, but Jonathan Kingdon embraces and illuminates evolution as the story of our path, past, and the path to a better Homo sapien future. Can you feel your inner ape in the story of human evolution? Are you surprised by all you don't know about how it actually happened? And do you buy Jonathan Kingdon's view that without understanding our evolutionary past, our future looks grim? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now in the studio is Jonathan Kingdon, renowned zoologist, wildlife artist, and evolutionary biologist, and author of the new book, Lowly Origin, Where, When, and Why Our Ancestors First Stood Up. Good evening and welcome, Jonathan Kingdon.
Good evening. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Also with us tonight from Hanover, New Hampshire, is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, and hello to our guest.
Jonathan Kingdon, you start right in at the very title with Lowly Origin, a phrase you've taken from Charles Darwin. Why this phrase? What's the significance of the phrase for human history and for your book?
Well, Darwin, right at the beginning of his book, told us that we had a lowly origin, and he also ended with this idea that in spite of all our magnificent achievements, we shouldn't forget that we have a lowly origin. And, of course, he meant a lot of very early ancestors. He was looking at little worm-like creatures. He was looking at the very earliest kind of vertebrates. And he was looking at very primitive primates. But I'm also looking at a particular moment, which I think is very significant, which is when we call ourselves hominins and distinguish ourselves from apes by the moment in which we start to be bipedal. And that's become the kind of de facto definition of what a hominin is.
The dividing line between the past and the hominin era that we're still part of as Homo sapiens.
Yes, yes.
Walk us through that, because I think many people had a grade school education in this that may or may not even have encompassed all of it. You know, we know Cro-Magnon and Neanderthal, but you're really going back even before that.
A lot earlier than that, yes. We're talking about something between 6 and 7 million years as the period when these events took place. And in the past, people have really tried to imagine it. They had very few fossils. And one of the differences in the present time is that we've got lots more fossils. And indirectly, we're getting a lot of data also from genetics. We're beginning to understand just where we, particularly with molecular clocks, which give a timing for the parting of the ways. So if you look at the genes of a gorilla and we look at the genes of a chimp or an orangutan, we can actually create a tree through a molecular clock, which tells us, anyway, very roughly, when we had a common ancestor. And the interesting thing is that the orangutan, the last common ancestor, was probably somewhere around about 14, 15 million years ago. Mm-hmm. The gorilla is something like 9 million years, and the chimp is more like 7. So in a sense, we're more closely related to the chimp than the chimp is to the gorilla. Now, that's a terrific thing to take on board. I just couldn't take it on board when I first heard it.
It's a great stretch to imagine.
It really is. But it just means something quite amazing has happened to us in the time since we parted company from the chimp. And not so much has happened to the chimp.
And it's this standing up, this going bipedal, as you say, that you describe as the dividing line that brings us into that whole era.
Well, no, I'm just borrowing something which everyone has assumed to be the dividing line. I think actually it's a much more protracted process than that. And what we've chosen is to say getting up on your hind legs is the defining moment. So I took that really as the title for the theme for the book. This is the defining moment. And yet there were many other moments both before that and after that.
We want to get into the detail of your projection of everything that you've learned into the deep past and how it came to pass that this creature stood up on its hind legs. But I wanted to get a sense across first of your own personal history and how your view of evolutionary biology may have grown out of it. As you may know, in the United States, there is, all these years after Darwin, still quite a vigorous debate over evolution, and parents who demand that it be taught in school as just one option among many, and creationism still as a live idea and belief in the minds of many. Your, even before your science, your entire life has been rooted in Africa, and I wonder how that has played into your kind of innate understanding of evolution. Can you give us a sense of your youth, your growing up, and how it's played into your scientific perspective?
I think it's very understandable that evolution is a difficult concept to take on board if you live in a society where you are not in intimate contact with creatures like chimps and gorillas and lions and a lot else besides. I grew up with these as familiar parts of my environment, and therefore they were not unfamiliar, and I could empathize much more readily with a thing like a chimp or a gorilla because I saw them as true living animals, living in a real landscape, in real space, real time. And also, even when I was a very small child, I was taken for a picnic in Olduvai Gorge. And, you know, that's a sort of mini Grand Canyon, if you like. Right. And you've got all these strips of different colored earths going up a cliff.
And all of history laid out in those bands.
Yeah, it's all laid out. And you know very well that the older ones are from the lower slices of this cake. And then it goes up the cake. And as you go up, it gets more recent. And there are changes in the fossils that you find in these different slices of the cake. And it's 2 million years, that particular gorge. And so, in a sense, I suppose I must have absorbed when I was, 5 years old, I think it was, 4 or 5 years old, just the idea that this was an environment, this was a landscape that had been inhabited by my ancestors. Not just for a few thousand years, or in the case of the States, only a few hundred years, but literally millions and millions of years. And in a sense, when you listen to the sounds and you look at the mountains and you realize the mountains have come and gone, you get a bit more of a grasp of the huge spans of history, the huge spans of time which are there.
Jack Beattie, for Jonathan Kingdon, growing up with that intimacy with Africa, becoming a wildlife artist who drew it very intimately and kind of taught himself the biology straight out of that experience, evolution is not a stretch. And yet, for many Americans, it remains a stretch.
It does. Dr. Kingdon may be surprised, maybe appalled, to learn that 3 times as many Americans believe in the virgin birth than in organic evolution. That is a bit of a comment, I think. And, you know, as I was reading his book, and especially keeping to the forefront this phrase, our lowly origins, it seemed to me that there was a kind of contrast here. That people that stress the divine origin, sort of the Genesis account, tend, it seems to me, to define the human problem as one of good and evil. Good over here and evil over there. That's the conflict in the world. whereas people who see the world as lowly origin, our primitive origin, see the world as good hyphen and evil hyphen. That is, the good and the evil are both in ourselves. They are not separate. And that is a very chastening and important, ethically important insight to gain, I think.
Jack, stand by. We have to take a short break. We're talking tonight with Jonathan Kingdon, author of Lowly Origin, about human evolution and where, when, and how our ancestors first stood up. If you presume human evolution, are you surprised by all you don't know about how it actually happened? You can call us. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about human evolution and where and when and how our ancestors first stood up, about the origin of the species and the path ahead. My guest tonight is Jonathan Kingdon. He's author of the new book, Lowly Origins, Where, When, and Why Our Ancestors First Stood Up. You can join the conversation as well. Does it bother you to be descended from an ape, or is the insult to the ape? And if creationism is your thing, how do you square that with Jonathan Kingdon's report from the field? Have you stopped to think of everything that flows from a species standing up? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Jonathan Kingdon, there's so much we want to ask you. I mean, we sit in a realm where evolution is the science of our time, and yet there's so much we don't really understand. We want to get to the standing up piece, but would you be good enough to paint the bigger picture for us first? Because we're always reading something in the newspaper about a new skull found here or the origin believed to be there. As best we understand it today, what's the very simple building blocks, the large pieces of the ascent of man and woman, if you will?
It's a world that's changing very, very, very fast, because not only is genetics moving very fast, but also a great many new fossils have been found in recent times. Less than 10 years ago, people could still believe in a single line of evolution which led from apes to man.
Okay.
And there were a limited number of fossils. And these have been growing very slightly over the last 50 years. Then this sudden access of new species, new fossils, which are every one posing new questions. So from a situation where you had three or four, you had Java man, you had Neanderthal skulls, which were found, you know, about 100 years ago. And now suddenly you've got maybe as many as 20 to 25 species of creatures that walked on their hind legs.
So you're saying the evolutionary map is much bushier than was imagined.
Much bushier. So there are many more creatures to take into account.
So
you've got to try and explain, why should there be so many? When we look at things like antelopes or finches or something like that in Africa, we see lots of antelopes, we see lots of finches. Mm-hmm. Well, the daunting thing is that we saw lots of two-legged animals, too. The fossil record now is quite unequivocal in showing us that Africa had a lot of these creatures around.
And all
now
but
there's
one
only
strain,
one left.
All but one strain, Homo
only
sapien.
Only one is left.
Conked out.
Yep.
But place that history in time and space, then. At this point, this kind of conceptual line crossing, going up on hind legs. Where did it happen? When did it happen? What's the movement of early hominins, as you will? I guess this is the precursor of Homo sapien. Where do they rise up, and where did they travel?
Well, they came in, probably the ancestor to gorillas, chimps, and us. Probably came in from Asia, curiously enough, when there was a land bridge about 10.5 million years ago.
A bridge from Asia
to
Africa?
Yes, across Arabia and into Africa. Mm-hmm. And that was a fairly generalized ape, probably, because formerly people thought that it was an indigenous ape from Africa, but they were a slightly different group, and anatomically it's not quite right. It's still possible that that is the case.
But more likely an ape-like creature 10 million years ago, you say?
Yes, round about that.
Across Arabia into Africa, and then?
And then diversifying, first of all, into gorillas, which probably entered into the forest round about that sort of time, and became distinct. And then this extraordinary separation between the chimps and the human beings, and that's almost certainly due to a climatic change, round about 7 million years ago, where a dry corridor cut off a population right over on the eastern side. And we have to remember that all the fossils come from the eastern side of the continent.
So some climatic change, a north-south dry corridor running down through Africa, isolating some portion in East Africa where the fossils are generally.
Yes. And that may be, I mean, lots of people regard that maybe just as a happenstance, as an accident. But the biology and the distribution of African animals, not just mammals, but also birds and a lot of other organisms, including plants, indicates that the eastern coast has a very high level of what we call endemism, uniqueness to that region. Mm-hmm. And all the fossil sites, which are scattered from Ethiopia down through Kenya and Tanzania, right the way down, and Malawi, down to extreme south of South Africa, well, that's very suggestive in itself.
So 10 million years ago, coming across a land bridge from Asia to Africa, climactic change, eastern Africa is where this life tends to be centered. Mm-hmm. And then somewhere, you're saying 6 or 7 million years ago, the standing up begins to occur.
Right. Now, the thing that's been missed, and it was missed by Darwin, too, because Darwin had the idea, and he was the very first person to even think of discussing this as a problem or seeing it as a problem or seeing it as something that was real. He reckoned that by standing up, you release the hands, and by releasing the hands, that was the step, that was the sort of introduction to becoming a human
being. From hands to tools and tools to everything that followed.
Right.
But we know that was hardly the final word. This is one of the most debated issues in anthropology.
Exactly.
And you list in your book a dozen or more hypotheses over time of why, how human ancestors stood up. Give us some of the others that have been put out there, suggested.
Well, some of them are really way out, like sort of going out and fishing for seaweed, and others are frightening the opposition, and others are, one is males bringing bribes for female favors and things like that.
I remember the one from school days of human ancestors standing up in the savannah to survey the horizon.
That's right. And there was a kind of imagination. They tried to imagine what it was like to be an ape in a nice wet forest, and then the climate dries out, and you've just got to get used to the change in your forest. And that just doesn't work. That's not how evolution works. You have to have separation of populations, and that's why this corridor is so important. You actually isolate a population in a place where they can survive. In my view, there had to be an intervening period, which is what I call squat foraging. In other words, these apes found lots of, they were omnivores, and they found lots of small items on the forest floor.
So they came out of the trees.
They came out of, well, they lived in wooded country, maybe.
But I mean, out of the treetops, I should say.
That's right, they came out. And these were relatively small forests, probably, you know, not of very high stature. So they came down onto the forest floor because the richest resources were on the forest floor. Fallen fruit, berries, roots, all sorts of little animals, which they could pop into their mouths.
But hardly standing right away, foraging.
No, squatting. That's the whole key to the thing. And that's what was missed and has been missed by almost everyone as an intervening stage between being on four legs and being on two legs.
Mm-hmm.
So if you intervene, I mean, if you stick in the middle of that, squat foraging, then you've got a very interesting thing to take on board, and that is that you sit there and you adjust the column of your
spine
back and the way your skull fits on the top. You modify your pelvis, and you also get used to using your hands. And your hands become the interface, the ultimate interface
because
between you and your environment.
Because they're free from walking.
They're free, yes. So that I'm inverting Darwin's idea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm saying actually freeing the hands was a direct product of being a squat forager, shuffling around in your backside on the forest floor.
So now the hands are freed, but still, why does that suggest standing up? Or
well,
how does it lead in that direction?
It leads in that direction because it changes your relationship with the environment. You are feeding on lots of small items, and your hands improve. Your hands begin to be able to do lots of things they couldn't do before because you were walking on all fours before that. And there's a link between the hand and the brain, which ultimately kicks in step by step by step. And so I think that actually that change in the relationship between the ape itself, mm-hmm. the squatting ape, and its environment in the total sense, with its food, with anything that it comes into contact, came through the hands.
But at this point in evolution, you're saying it's still not a single line from that creature to humans. There were many who made this step, who were squat foraging, to use your phrase.
Yes, yes.
But only one strain, only one species that survived. Why?
Well, that didn't all happen at once. Basically, strung
I guess
out...
nothing here happened at once, that's for sure.
Well, you know, they were strung out along about 4,000 kilometers. In other words, from what we today is Somalia and South Africa. That's a hell of a long way.
Yes, it is.
And it's also a very tentative distribution. So they got broken up into small populations. And those populations then moved inland, upriver, mm-hmm. into completely different regions of Africa, where they had different challenges, and they became different sorts of bipedal animals. So the shift from being a bum-shuffling ape, if
yes.
you like,
yes.
Down on the coast, and a bipedal creature inland can be seen sort of metaphorically as you move inland, you have to become bipedal, partly because there are many more challenges. Down on the coast, you could forage on the forest floor. But as soon as you started to be a bit more adventurous, you were on the edges of the forest. There you had to stand up and collect, say, berries off the bushes around. And
so what happened to all the other groups that didn't make it on down through time? The others who went bipedal, who got up at least squatting, maybe standing up, but are these other species today, or are they just gone?
They're gone. And they're gone, I think myself, largely because every innovation is at the expense of another animal. And our own innovations are at the expense of many more than just our own closest relatives, but also increasingly all the other species as well. So I think competition and competition for the resources there are. After all resources are limited,
mm-hmm.
and you have to have techniques for foraging. For instance, an anteater has a whole set of unique characteristics. It's got great big spade-like claws. It's got special digestion.
Yes.
It's got a weird tongue, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Well, every animal, in some way or other, has a special technique for making a living. But what we've done is to steadily devise more and more different ways of making many different sorts of livings.
I want to come to that. You describe Homo sapiens as niche thieves, mm-hmm. moving into the niches of other animals and stealing with all of our facilities, their specialty. But Jack Beattie, I want to turn to you first. You old African, you, with your bum shuffling ape for ancestors.
Absolutely.
And how does the story sit with you?
Well, it takes me down a peg, and I'm glad to be down a peg. I just want to return to that model I used earlier, that the theistic model tends to the view of good and evil, and the one that traces our lowly origin to the problem of good hyphen and hyphen evil. And if the problem of if that's your view, then life comes down to a matter of self-control, of learning how to control what's on the other side of that hyphen. And keeping those propensities under control, it means even that nations are both good hyphen and hyphen evil. And it means controlling them as well. Whereas if you look at the theistic idea, the divine origin of the species, you come to the notion that evil needs to be annihilated. You can't live with it. It's this antimony. It's this thing that demands annihilation. And that leads to a freeing up of the self-control that under the lowly origin we need to keep under control, that destructive impulse. So the one, it seems to me, Dr. Kingdon's view, leads to the recognition, really, that he gave when he flew back from holiday from Oxford to Africa, and someone asked him, what race are you? An immigration official, and he put down human. And that's the recognition. We're all, what did he say, squat foragers here. And
or maybe a step beyond. But yeah.
Perhaps. But we all have that common stem. And the notion of setting the planet in terms of differences, nations, religions, races, is a complication that has caused us no end of trouble, and now, as he points out, threatens the planet itself.
Well, but we'll get to this with Jonathan Kingdon, but he's also saying there's something in human nature itself as niche thieves, as we move in on the specialties, the terrain, the turf of other species, that we may have to come to terms with for the whole planet. We have a lot of callers who want to join right here. I want to invite them in. Beth is calling from Erie, Pennsylvania. Hi, Beth. You're on the air.
Hi, great show. Just wanted to weigh in on Jack Beatty's side. I mean, would you rather think of us as creatures created intentionally for the capacity for evil, or that, you know, the things in our beings that pose such problems for the human race are really sort of the vestige of the process that generated us? For me, it's much more optimistic to think of the evolutionary view, then we were intentionally created defectively.
We got the point. I personally prefer to think of it all, at least in this context, in terms of science. But let me take that, Beth and Jack, and put it to you, Jonathan Kingdon. This idea of the idea of evil, I don't even know does it fit into your kind of big storyline about evolution? The only place, but it is a place where I may see it, is You describe this kind of omnivorous human capacity to eat up every resource around us as a ultimately perhaps a species flaw that we may have to come to terms with, lest we risk kind of overrunning, using up the Earth.
Yes, I do think that. And I think that we do have responsibility for the world we're in. And I think that very often what is called evil is created in a very thoughtless and maybe innocent way. That we do things as a result of appetite for the most part. And one of the great virtues of religious thinking is to recognize that we are creatures of appetite. And the best strains in religion have always encouraged us to actually control our appetites and not just live to indulge them. And I think that element of religious teaching should be kept, very much so.
You're very respectful of a lot of early religious writing. You're saying these were wise people trying to make sense of
the
very mysterious world.
In, yes. And after all, we do live in a mysterious world. And I can't help remembering a story told to me by a friend who I think was with Peace Corps in Ethiopia. And he was with people who live on the plateau above the Red Sea, and they live on little villages on flat lands which are bordered by huge cliffs. Mm-hmm. And he was teaching them about geography, and he taught them that the world was round. And he had a delegation of elders come to see him, and they said, "We're very grateful to you for all the wonderful teaching you're giving our children, but there is one thing." And they came in all their robes and in very solemnly, and they said, "But you are teaching them that the world is round. It is not. It is flat." And that's very understandable. If you live in the place they did, it's actually how they perceive the world.
We all come from the place we come from. We're talking tonight with Jonathan Kingdon about his new book, Lowly Origin, about human evolution, the origin of the species, and the path ahead. You can join the conversation. Are humans somehow reluctant or afraid to look at their own animal nature? Why? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about human evolution, the origin of the species, and the path ahead. My guest tonight is zoologist, wildlife artist, and British evolutionary biologist Jonathan Kingdon. His new book is Lowly Origin, Where, When, and Why Our Ancestors First Stood Up. You can join the conversation. Are you at peace with your inner ape? Does it all add up to you? And why is America still debating whether we've descended from apes or angels? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Paul's calling from Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Hello. And I your main question, do I have a problem with being descended of an ape? I can't remember the way you said it.
Yes.
And the answer is no. I have no problem with that. As a matter of fact, I can understand that. My understanding is from my general understanding from scholars and science and my own intuition that I'm probably a descendant of the primordial ooze.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see from that point a organic growth. This is, you know, carbon, hydrogen, oxygen, nitrogen, and whatever other elements. I can see positive growth to where we are today. I don't accept a good and evil battle or ingredients to any of us. I accept a positive growth and a negative growth, and the positive dominates over the negative.
So you see a positive progress through evolution, and you're glad for it.
Yes, and this is a realistic point of view and not an optimistic one. My realism gives me optimism, but I don't start with pure optimism like a blank check.
Mm-hmm.
I look at things as realistically as I can, and I can see optimism. I can see the positive growth dominating. I can see how we, for example, the human mentality alone has progressed. I don't like that word either, progress, but has grown positively from our animal near minds to what they are today. I use time. The time, for example, I take the peace-loving Scandinavians today and what they were doing to the world and to each other 1,000, 1,500 years ago.
Paul, we've got it, and I want to put it all to our guest, Jonathan Kingdon, but thanks for your call. Jonathan, what about this idea of putting a value judgment, a positive-negative judgment on evolution? Do you do that? Do you look at evolution and say it's positive or it's negative, or is it simply what is?
Well, in a sense, yes, it's what is. But what I did like about the last question was the question of whether you are positive or negative. And for me, the definition of being positive is to anticipate that our descendants will still be on this earth and will be still struggling to with issues in, say, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000 years from
mm-hmm.
now.
Mm-hmm.
And they
the,
will...
The blink of an eye in your terms.
Yes, yes. And if we've got this past, which we're only just beginning to get a glimpse of, then we've got to be thinking responsibly about all those descendants that are thousands of years ahead, and we're not thinking about them. We're not thinking about their needs, and we're not thinking about the sort of world that we're going to bequeath to them.
And when you say that, you're not just making the argument about clean air and clean water that we normally hear. As I read you, you're saying we may even be erasing some of the evolutionary evidence that they may need to understand themselves and their, mm-hmm. Our common origins.
Yes, and I think we may also be creating a world in which the simple animal joys of just joie de vivre, loving life, and loving the things we find on this planet, because they're all our cousins, they're all we are related to everything, the vegetable world as well as the animal world, mm-hmm. and we should take joy in that, and we should keep that sense of joy in the world as we find it, and not wipe it out and create a kind of hysteria within ourselves, which is generated by internal mental models, which we have allowed to run out of control.
But tip away from that possibility of joy, and I almost read you a warning of a kind of devolution.
Yes, I think that's a distinct possibility if we cut off all our links with our animal past.
Keith is calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Keith. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am a creationist. I grew up in a Christian household. The issue that I have is if you take God out of the equation and rely on evolutionary theory, I think your morals go away. I believe we are created with morals, you know, referring back to the good and evil. If an animal of one species kills an animal of the same species, we look at it and go, well, that's what they do. But we don't look at it that way. We understand that there's, you know, a right and wrong, a good and evil, that if you kill a fellow man, that's wrong.
So you want to keep the Ten Commandments around it, and that link seems necessary in your mind to humanity in a way. Jonathan Kingdon, what about it? Keith, thanks for your call. Keith says, take God out and morals go away. As an evolutionary biologist, how do you look at that premise?
Well, I think there have been many magnificent religions, and I think one has to remember that the Egyptian religion, for example, which had gods and was very moral in its own terms, lasted for well over 2,000 years. And a lot more, in fact, mm-hmm. more like 3,000 or 4,000 mm-hmm. years. And there isn't any religion around today. And I've grown up in a multi-religious background. Mm-hmm. So I've been surrounded by Muslims and Hindus and animists and Christians all my life. Mm-hmm. And I respect all religions. And particularly, I respect their origins. But I don't respect an attitude which sees religion and science as enemies. I think that science is the greatest triumph of the Western intellectual tradition. And I think anyone who rejects that is really rejecting something that is profoundly human and has within it the capacity for moral judgments and moral behavior. And we haven't begun to elaborate what that is because we've been too willing to put that into the religious box and not actually apply it to a scientific view of life. And I think that's got to happen.
That embrace, that saying, yes. Science is part of what's been produced through all of this creation, and we must embrace it.
Yes.
Dave's calling from West Yarmouth, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello, Dave. Are you there?
Hi.
Hi.
Greetings. I wondered if Mr. Kingdon?
Yes, Kingdon.
Might tell me whether or not we know a lot about our human development and all throughout the lifespan from childhood on. And what if we were able to teach everyone about their own human development and they could focus their interests and talents on maximizing their own individual development? I wonder if that could be considered a step of cognitive evolution.
You're saying, is there room for like actively pushing evolution forward by our education and our upbringing?
That's right, an intellectual form, I suppose.
Dave, thanks for your call. Jonathan Kingdon, I wonder if this doesn't go to something you conclude your book with, and you do suggest that for its own sake and the sake of other species, Homo sapiens need to adopt some new behaviors or need to curb some old behaviors. Can active learning play a role in evolution? Is there evidence of that in human evolution? Or is that a silly question?
No, I don't think it's silly at all. But I would disagree with the idea that we know a lot. That was the way our questioner started his
yes.
statement. We
yes.
know a lot. Mm-hmm. We don't know a lot. We are at the beginning of a great voyage of discovery. We've been making enormous leaps of in new knowledge in the last 10 years particularly, but obviously throughout the scientific
era.
The history of mm-hmm. science in the Western world, and not only in the Western world, but I think we need to be much more humble about our knowledge. We are at the beginning of great new discoveries about the nature of the universe we find ourselves in. So it's probably premature to make hard and fast rules for how we should conduct ourselves. But we certainly should be struggling to find much more realistic ways of relating to the world we find ourselves in. And I think that is what we're not really doing very effectively at the moment.
And Jack Beatty, Jonathan Kingdon says, or suggests anyway, that some of the science that we pursue, even romping around on the moon, may be ultimately less significant than continuing to ponder our own human origins.
Yes, that in some sense these ventures, these Faustian flights are an escape, aren't they? A distraction from just what Dave was really talking about, human development, which is really a matter of self-cultivation, a matter really, it seems to me, of grasping the we of me, that forever seeing that the other person is just in some striking and basic way like you, that they hurt when they're stabbed, that they starve, that they go hungry, that they know what it is to suffer. And that, it seems to me, is the central insight, that an ethical insight that can come out of a study of evolutionary biology.
I agree very much, sir. I think that's very well put.
Let's get another call. John's calling from Conway, Massachusetts. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. I have what is perhaps a naive question that was really spurred by your earlier comments about how the evolutionary tree was quite bushy, but now that there's just one left, and that's us.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered whether it's possible that there were, concurrent with our existence today, other branches to this tree, other kind of the next step in human evolution could have branched off at some point in the past and could be developing in parallel with us. And we're not aware of it, as some of these earlier branches may not have been aware of the existence of Homo sapiens.
But, John, how could that be? You mean they'd be so deep in the forest that even now they would never have been seen?
No, I mean that kind of embedded in our society, that the next step in human evolution may be occurring, and we as Homo sapiens today are unaware of it.
Oh, I see. Right among us. I think we've got that. Jonathan King, do you see John is asking if maybe even within our ranks we're not all of the same species, or there's evolution going on selectively or in some minority of the human population? Is that within the realm of imagination?
No, I don't think that there's any potential for that. There is, within the diversity of humans, an enormous capacity for discovering new things within ourselves. But I really do subscribe to the democratic principle that all people are, in a sense, born equal. Obviously, they may be born with disabilities of one sort or another, but all of us have within us much more potential than we ever realize. And that is also true about science and about all our institutions. Our institutions are very partial in their success, and our thinking is very partial in its success, I think.
As an evolutionary biologist, do you see that untapped potential as still awaiting evolutionary discovery over vast periods of time? Will humans, you know, knock wood, unlock that? Is that all waiting to be unlocked?
Well, perhaps, yes. I think more than anything, we need more and more information to be able to make good judgments about anything. It doesn't matter whether it's about science, interplanetary travel, or about our own origins. We need information. And the people in the past who struggled with very little information had to put it across to people in metaphorical language. So a lot of the Bible, a lot of the Quran, a lot of the Upanishads or whatever are actually couched in terms of poetry and in terms of metaphor. And we probably still need to put things into metaphor because we need to make them easily accessible and easily understandable in terms of our own very transitory lives.
But you say, let's keep bringing the information in.
We need much more information to feed our myths, to feed our metaphors, and to feed our imagination. We need imagination, but we need imagination that is built on fact and not just on fancy.
Jonathan Kingdon, we're glad for your lifetime in Africa and for the intimacy of art that brought you so close to zoology and animals and for all the insights of your new book and sharing them with us tonight. Thanks very much for coming in.
Well, it's a delight to be here. Thank you.
Jonathan Kingdon, author of Lowly Origin, Where, When, and Why Our Ancestors First Stood Up. Jack Beattie, we are still a work in progress.
We sure are. And this defective creature, to go back to our first caller, has a taste for low entertainments. And now I'm going to go and watch, oh, I don't know, Bedtime for Bonzo. See my ancestor
well,
at work.
It's all in the family there, Jack.
It sure is.
Well, always a lot to chew on. I wish we had another hour of this, but we don't. Happy foraging, Jack.
Sure.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Thank you.